Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've come on this Friday to the end of Jobs Week. Speeches have been spoken, policy papers have been written. Now all that's left is the waiting for Congress to act and then for something to happen. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 9th of September today. Good to have you with us. All the ideas for getting jobs going again in this country, no matter where they come from, are crucial to one group that barely even knows what a healthy labor market looks like: young people. So that's where we're going to start today on the breakdown, our economy one step at a time, the future. Because the unemployment rate among 20 to 24-year-olds is nearly 15%. Kids come out of college today, start looking for a job, and if they can find one, it's just plain lousy. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out to Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, to ask around.
When Temeskin Hobta started college, the country was in the grips of a subprime housing crash, and millions of jobs were about to be erased from the economy. Now, the 21-year-old philosophy major from Washington, D.C., is heading toward graduation.
They were telling us when we were freshmen, you're very lucky to be in school right now, because by the time you graduate, the economy will have rebounded. Obviously, that isn't the case. The seniors especially, you find that they're extremely anxious.
But not necessarily tuning in to the president's promises about job creation last night. Hobta was sprawled out in front of a big screen TV in the student center, and he was watching the speech alone.
With the three proud words of Made in America.
Outside on the lawn, dozens of students were playing with puppies at something called Dog Day, and senior Simon Hudis told me they didn't even know they'd scheduled it at the same time as the president's speech.
Dogs are really fun things to play with. President, not so much.
But just because students aren't focused on plans to fix the job market doesn't mean they're not worried. I found senior psychology major Joseph Sibilia Young at a bike workshop in his dorm.
I think it's kind of that unacknowledged elephant in the living room that we all know we're screwed. I'm a little scared. It's a good time to be a student, but a terrible time to be paying off debts.
Which leads fellow senior Dylan Ferentz to conclude,
considering the economy's so good, I'm planning on going back to grad school.
In clinical psych, which will get him out, he thinks, in
2016, 17.
Do you think the economy will be better by then, or you'll just be more equipped to cope with it?
Well, I'll definitely have better credentials to get a better paying job. However, I don't really know what to expect. Politics will change. The job market will change.
Junior Helen Mead wants to know the job market will change for the better next year.
I'm going to be a teacher, so I really need a job when I graduate.
Mead was out throwing frisbee with Ethan Bruno. He's a sophomore.
From high school, I had no worries at all. And then with the stocks going down, my parents have been talking to me about money and how I need to earn a lot more of it.
What are you hoping to do when you get out?
No clue. Maybe business school, law school.
One great thing about being young, you can often see unlimited possibility ahead.
Well, I came into college thinking I would be an international affairs major and, like, work for the UN.
This is sophomore Angela Parisi.
And then that completely didn't work out for me. So now I am a media studies major.
So what are you hoping to do?
Something with music or art in the media. I have no idea yet. We're just seeing what happens.
Which doesn't sit well back home.
My family keeps telling me to think about the economy, but I'm really not worried about it. I'm going to make connections and network here at school, and I think that I'm going to get a job.
In Portland, Oregon, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Once the president finished speaking last night, students from the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism spoke to CEOs from a variety of corporate walks of life to get their thoughts. You can read what they had to say at marketplace.org. It's our website, of course. There is the small matter of the markets to mention. They were down today. Greece again, if you're looking for the most likely reason why. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So it's been all jobs all the time on the broadcast this week, as you know. And then we came across this irony. Just as the president's unveiling his $500 billion plan to bring back jobs, word leaks that one of the biggest banks in the country, Bank of America, could lay off as many as 40,000 people. B of A calls it a makeover. Others aren't quite so polite, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Just yesterday, Bank of America laid off 3,500 employees. It's likely to cut more than 10 times as many soon. But if you walk over to Bank of America skyscraper in Manhattan, like I did, you won't find newly demoralized workers. What you'll find is people whose attitude is, so what else is new?
They have to answer the same question over and over again. Is my parent company viable? Is it going to survive? What's going to happen to the assets if it doesn't?
That's Josh Brown, a financial planner for Fusion Analytics. He notes Bank of America has been through two brutal mergers with Merrill Lynch and Countrywide, government help, and 3 years of mortgage lawsuits. Bad news keeps piling up, which is why Brown doesn't own any Bank of America shares.
No, I'm not a masochist.
Another round of layoffs may not do enough to fix Bank of America. Michael Yoshikami is founder of YCMNet Advisors.
We don't own Bank of America shares because we're just not clear about what the bottom looks like in terms of their financial issues.
Bank of America is trying to become a leaner, more profitable bank. That means potentially unwinding some of the mergers at the root of its problems.
They got big eyes, bigger than what their stomachs could handle. That's how a great consumer bank ends up becoming basically a trash pile of financial assets.
Bank of America's CEO plans to outline his makeover plan on Monday. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The company my brother works for filed for bankruptcy the other day. Not something that would ordinarily merit a mention, except for this. He works in the solar panel industry, and this is the second solar company he's ridden into Chapter 11 in 3 years. Times are hard in the photovoltaic cell business. Also, the last time I talked to him, he said the place was crawling with FBI agents yesterday. He works at a company called Solyndra. We've got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the line to explain what's going on. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
So for the people who, until 3 days ago, had never heard of Solyndra, why is this company and its bankruptcy so controversial?
Well, in March of 2009, Solyndra was the first company to receive a loan from the Department of Energy to help create green jobs and new green industries. It got more than $500 million. The Department of Energy actually bragged at the time that it had rushed this loan application through. And later, it was revealed by the Government Accountability Office that they had failed to do some of their due diligence before announcing the deal. This became a much bigger political issue when Solyndra started running into financial problems. And reporters at the Center for Public Integrity revealed that one of the company's big financial backers was also a fundraiser for President Obama, a guy named George Kaiser.
Which is, at the very least, an appearance of impropriety, and investigations will figure that out. But businesses go bad in this country every single day, right?
No, that's right. And failure doesn't necessarily prove there was fraud or corruption. You know, Solyndra has a pretty innovative solar technology. They're trying to crack the solar problem in a way no one else has. And that's a risky bet. And so far, at least, there isn't any public evidence that the White House, the Department of Energy, or even Solyndra executives did anything illegal. But, you know, the Department of Energy's Inspector General has to be intensely curious if the company misled it, the government, about its financial situation, especially while it was trying to renegotiate some loans recently. And Republicans in Congress are looking for evidence that the White House somehow, you know, played favorites here.
Yeah. So here's another question, though. I mean, the government plays favorites in a way with tax policy and incentives and all of that. It does it all the time. But when you get to these new technologies, is it smart necessarily for the Department of Energy or any other branch of the government to be involved in that kind of investment?
If you think back to March of 2009, when the Department of Energy announced this deal, you know, there wasn't a lot of other capital out there. The financial markets were broken. And so there was a conscious decision made by Congress and the Department of Energy and the administration that this was a time where it was appropriate to try and imitate, you know, venture capitalists and make big investments in growing the economy. Solyndra was a risky investment. You know, it's not necessarily a corrupt one. It may not have even been a stupid one. The market shifted under the company's feet. They got clobbered by cheap imports from China and firms in the U.S. that figured out how to make solar panels a lot more cheaply. You know, should Solyndra executives have seen that coming? Maybe. Should the DOE have seen it coming? You know, there are analysts out there who say yes, but it's important to remember private investors poured money into this company too, and just like the government, they lost it.
Marketplace's Steve Henn on the fate of Solyndra, the recently bankrupt solar company. Steve, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Coming up,
I've been given a second chance at life. What do I want to do? Do I want to continue to do this? Or do I want to do something completely different?
Survivors and their choices, the legacy of September 11th. But first, let's do the numbers. So, at least it's Friday. The Dow Industrials plunged 2.67% today, 303 points closed at 10,992. The Nasdaq slid 2.4%. That's 61 points. Ended at 2467. The S&P 500 sank 2.67%. 31 points. Ended at 1154. For the week, the Dow gave back 2.2%. The Nasdaq off about 0.5%. The S&P 500 slipped 1.67%. Renewed fears about a Greek default pushed financial firms lower. Not that Bank of America needed any help. It laid off more than 3% today. Amid reports it's going to cut, as Heidi Moore was telling us, up to 40,000 jobs. On Monday, Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase both unloaded more than 4%. Goldman Sachs peeled off close to 2.5% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The next Miss Universe is crowned. The pageant takes place in Sao Paulo, Brazil. For you tennis fans out there, the U.S. Open wraps. The men's singles final is on Monday. Good luck. And on September 12, 1953, Jacqueline Lee Bouvier and John F. Kennedy were married. A reception was held for more than 1,200 guests. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As presidents like to do after they make a big policy speech, President Obama's out politicking today, trying to build support for his most recent jobs plan, of course. And so our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond is going to be a little bit different. We're going to use the president's speech last night to cap off a week of coverage of the American labor market and try to answer in the process this question. What happens now? Here to do that with us are Michael Spence from New York University's Stern School of Business, Catherine Mann from Brandeis University, and Michael Greenstone from MIT and the Hamilton Project at Brookings. Welcome to you all.
Thank you for having
Pleasure.
Us.
Thank you for having us.
Michael Spence, let me start with you. You have written in your academic work and in your book out earlier this year that the jobs that are lost in this economy are never coming back, that it's a structural change in the American and global economy. What does that mean?
Briefly, for the last couple of decades, we created quite a lot of jobs in the American economy, and all of them were in the part of the economy that we sometimes call non-tradable. That means that goods and services that don't trade internationally. The other part, the tradable sector, hasn't generated much employment. And if you look at manufacturing industries, they're actually very long, complex supply chains. And the lower value-added parts, meaning the parts that require less skilled labor and so on, goods and services, components, are migrating to other parts of the global economy where they're more naturally located.
So, Catherine Mann, if that follows, then the theory is that we have to grow jobs domestically. How do we do that?
Well, I think if we look at the type of policies that were put forward in the president's speech last night, they are get back to work policies. They're designed to move people from just taking an unemployment check to you can get unemployment, but you got to go train. we're going to give you a payroll tax because we'd like you to spend in the local economy. So the local economy gets some job creation and they get some spending.
Michael Greenstone, acknowledging that there are no magic bullets, there are no silver bullets that will end this. If you had to pick one thing as a point of departure for where do we go now, what is it?
I think for the short-run problem, some of the policies around incentivizing hiring through payroll tax cuts for new hires are really excellent ideas and ways to get lots of bang for the buck, given the current fiscal environment. That's especially important.
Mike Spence, let me pick up on something that has been talked about a lot. That is the difference between the short-term crisis and the long-term problem. How do you fix that structurally so that we can have both ends of that equation work out?
Well, you know, what makes the current situation so hard is that we're trying to solve a long-term problem with a very constrained fiscal situation. The short-run thing that we can do, the president did last night, which is to tackle a jobs problem and not try to have it all entirely focused on fixing the budget situation quickly. But the longer-term problem is that we have to turn the tradable sector of the economy into an employment-generating engine, which means that we have to expand its scope. And that's going to take a whole variety of things, technology, education and skills, a commitment from the business community, including the multinationals, who are basically the architects of these global supply chains. It's probably going to take tax reform, probably going to take a sensible energy policy.
Catherine Mann, that was a fairly formidable list that Mike Spence just offered, a long list of things to do. Can we get there from here?
Well, I'd like to pick up a little bit on what Michael was saying about the tradable sector.
Well, let's remind people what that is. It's the part of the economy where we interact with the rest of the world.
Right, right. And we need to think about increasing the participation of both firms and workers in this globalization and international trade. We need to be thinking about more firms, more markets, in other words, more countries around the world that we trade with, because as it turns out, almost all of those exports, 50% or so, are one firm to one market.
Michael Greenstone, I would submit that there are workers all over this country who would love to participate in the tradable sector of the economy. And the catch being that either their wages are stuck or they actually aren't workers. They're out of a job. Is there a way that this economy recovers without some kind of job creation program?
I'd like to pivot to the long-run problems just for a minute. We've kind of let our skills, or at least our relative skills, deteriorate. Basically, for 35 years, the fraction of men who have high school degrees and college degrees has been flat. We've seen a total stagnation of test scores. And the really surprising thing is that that's going on at the very same time that the market is just shouting out, get more education. We'll give you more money if you do. How can we increase the skills of our workforce so that we can be more competitive in the tradable sector and just generally?
I have heard nothing yet so far from either of you three, any of you three, I suppose, that offers hope. So, Michael Spence, is there a way that this works out well?
Oh, absolutely. What I worry about is that we haven't fully accepted as a nation, and I'm talking about all of us as citizens, that we have just lived through a period up to the crisis where we were over-consuming and under-investing. And if we really want to get this job done, there's going to be a period of belt-tightening, you know, where we consume less and invest more in our children and grandchildren's future. But I'm not pessimistic about the question of whether we'll get around to doing that.
Michael Greenstone of the Hamilton Project at Brookings and MIT, Mike Spence at the Stern School at NYU, and Catherine Mann at Brandeis University. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We started our look at the 10th anniversary of September 11th this week, trying to get a grasp on the economics of it, the costs, real and perceived, to our society and to our lives. And we talked to a guy, an economist, who said September 11th wasn't really about the economics or the costs. It was about our souls, he said. So today, the stories of seven people who lived through that day in New York City, how it changed them and changed what they do.
It was a beautiful, crystal clear September day that day.
It was a really beautiful day.
I was in my room getting ready for work when the first plane crashed into the North Tower.
We heard this incredibly loud, booming sound.
That sound you hear if a truck drives over those metal plates.
People started yelling, "Get out!" And we could see from our office, Building 1 had been hit.
And then I looked up and saw a massive hole in Tower 1.
There was paper everywhere.
Glass, pieces of large metal, just fiery debris.
Just kept drifting down from the sky, you know, almost like a snowstorm.
And then a guy fell right in front of our window where, so close, we could see the details. So, you know, you could see that he was alive, that he was screaming, that he was wearing a pink tie. He had sandy blonde hair.
There was nothing on my mind more than, I just want to see my wife. I want to go home.
When the building started to sway, you know, underneath my feet, that's at the point which I thought, you know, maybe I'm not going to make it out of this building.
The first thing I did on the morning afterwards was call the office. And it was a good thing because they thought I was dead.
You know, our emails, I guess they had recovered our emails. So I had all these old emails in my inbox from people that had since passed.
As soon as I got up out of the subway, you could smell the smoke. And I would just start crying as I walked to work.
You go deep inside your psyche and think, what do I want to do? You know, I've been given a second chance at life. What do I want to do? Do I want to continue to do this? Or do I want to do something completely different?
Because all of a sudden you realize there are no guarantees of tomorrow.
What I started doing was I was starting to write about what had happened that day. That was the beginning of what became that day in September, a one-man show. Eventually it opened off-Broadway in New York in August of 2003.
I decided that I would go back to university and finish my degree, and I received a doctorate in clinical psychology in 2010. And I felt that I could understand somebody else if they, God forbid, had to go through anything like this and, you know, try to be there for them.
I started the Marriott World Trade Center Survivors Group. So my second job is really to run the organization, keep it going.
And I'd always thought about becoming a teacher. 9/11, you know, it just made me want to make a change. And now I've been teaching for 6 years.
My husband and I decided together that we were going to go into business together. Time is very precious. And if I'm going to spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week doing something, I want to be with somebody that I want to be with.
You know, I'm coaching baseball, I'm coaching soccer, I'm on the local school board. I do stretch myself pretty thin, but, you know, I said I'm going to get more involved, and that's the way I'm giving back.
I'm an insurance guy. That's what I do. I don't believe that a terrorist attack should stop me from doing what it is that I do best. But I'm not the workaholic I used to be. And at 8:48 every morning, I've been driving my poor wife nuts for the last 10 years because I still call her every morning at 8:48 just to let her know that I'm okay.
My name is Don Baxo. On September 11, 2001, I was in World Trade Center Tower 1 on the 57th floor.
My name is Angela Brock Bokern, and I worked for Morgan Stanley in the second tower on the 61st floor.
My name is Adam Elsrode. I was working at Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank's office was across the street from 2 World Trade Center.
My name is Joyce Ng. I was at the Marriott Hotel, which was part of the World Trade Center complex.
My name is Artie Van Wy. My office building was across the street from the World Trade Center.
I am Joe Dittmar. I was on the 105th floor of 2 World Trade Center, attending a meeting at the Aon Corporation.
I'm Laura Grant. I was working for Aon Corporation in the World Trade Center, Tower 2, Floor 104.
There are more September 11th survivor stories on our website and a place for you to share your own memories of that day. And you can hear the rest of our coverage of the economic legacy of 9/11 right there as well, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, just to get back to that idea that the legacy of September 11th fundamentally isn't about economics or money. CNBC's Maria Bartiromo was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange today at the close, as she usually is when there's a big day up or down. And I saw this on her Twitter feed this afternoon. Calmest, quietest 300-point sell-off I've ever seen, she said. My guess is that people had other things on their minds. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow dropped 303 points, 2.2%. The NASDAQ off 61 points, 2.4%. The S&P 500 down 31 points, 2.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, post-financial trauma, stress disorder.
Imagine someone who put all their eggs in one basket, didn't have a backup plan, and really prided themselves in being able to sort of take care of the people they love, and it's suddenly gone.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We're back here on Monday. This is APM. That's American Public Media.